Our last case this morning is 2021-1033, State of Ohio versus Susan Gwynn. Sitting on behalf of Justice, or I should say in place of Justice Donnelly, is Judge Mary Jane Trapp, who is judge from the 11th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you.
I will start with the appellant, Mr. Jaquith.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, Craig Jaquith on behalf of Susan Gwynn. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The Court of Appeals below has twice determined that Susan Gwynn's effective life without parole sentence shocks the conscience. That court, however, has found that it could not remedy her excessive sentence. Excuse me. But if the applicable statutes are followed or a constitutional approach is followed, Ms. Gwynn's sentence can and should be reduced. First, it must be noted that Revised Code Section 2929.41A makes concurrent sentences the presumptive norm in the state of Ohio. Obviously, the General Assembly has enacted that most recently in 2011. To reach consecutive terms of imprisonment, that cannot be done unless the sentencing court makes certain findings under 2929.14C4. One of those findings is that the trial court must find that consecutive terms are not disproportionate to the danger that the offender poses to the public. We submit that in this case, the record does not support a finding that consecutive terms are not disproportionate to the danger that Ms. Gwynn poses to the public. And if she were to receive an 8-year sentence on one of the burglary counts and then were to serve a 3-year term of post-release control after that 8 years, consecutive terms of imprisonment would not be necessary. Ms. Gwynn accepted responsibility for her offenses, pled guilty to 46 counts. My understanding from the sentencing transcript is that she pled guilty to the first offer from the state, did not attempt to come back for fewer counts. Counsel for Ms. Gwynn noted, I believe at page 18 of the sentencing transcript, that he advised her that he believed that there were defenses to many of these counts, and she said, no, I'd like to take responsibility and accept this plea and move forward. Additionally, during sentencing, she represented, she expressed remorse, indicated that this behavior would not be repeated in the future. Further, that she had no prior felony record. There was no physical harm threatened or committed against any individual.
Were all of her victims nursing home or assisted living residents?
As far as I know.
And that's a setting that she would not be permitted to work in.
Absolutely.
Today.
Counsel, to reach your Eighth Amendment question, your proposition, do we have to overrule State v. Hairston?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
I believe in the briefing, there's a suggestion that Hairston created a categorical rule that made sense under the facts of Hairston, that he had served 2 prior prison terms, he had committed acts that involved either physical harm or threats of physical harm, and his prior service demonstrated that he was not amenable to rehabilitation. Thus, this court could essentially limit or clarify Hairston to indicate that Hairston still remains good law for somebody in a position similar to Hairston, but because Hairston created a categorical rule based on facts very different from Ms. Gwynn and other future defendants, that Hairston should be limited to situations, can be limited to situations similar to that presented by Mr. Hairston.
Would we have to abandon State v. Saxon for that we don't take up sentence packaging?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Isn't that the issue here?
I don't think it ultimately is. The issue is whether, when we are presented with a sentence that shocks the conscience, the United States Supreme Court has indicated that it's appropriate to look to to an analysis that whether or not that is a grossly, there's a suggestion that once you can reach that conclusion that shocks the conscience, that's grossly disproportionate to the behavior, and that the sentence must be set aside. Where it goes from there will vary from state to state.
In Hairston, didn't we approve a 200-year sentence?
If I recall correctly, it was 130. It was over 100 years.
It was over 100.
It was also effective.
It was a long time.
Also effective life without parole.
And we upheld that?
Yes.
So wouldn't we have to overrule Hairston?
Again, I believe that the court could clarify that the categorical rule created in Hairston applies in that situation, and in different situations that Hairston didn't present, a different rule could apply. Alternatively, I did note that the underpinnings in the briefing, I noted that the underpinnings of Hairston are that in my view, shaky at best, because the only United States Supreme Court case cited in Hairston, to my recollection, is O'Neill versus Vermont, which at the time said that the Eighth Amendment didn't even apply to the states.
Counselor, if Ms. Gwynn were to have all of her convictions run concurrently, what would be her total amount of prison time?
Because the highest level offense is an F2, her sentence could be as high as 8 years.
And how many counts were there?
She pled guilty to 46 total.
To 46 total.
But in that agreement, 54 were dismissed.
Yeah, yes.
But in terms of our authority to review the sentence and the problems that are there now with statutory amendments and Jones, we still have the ability to look at whether the sentence is contrary to law as opposed to record does not support the sentence, correct?
Correct.
And how would we do that? What would be the analysis?
As I've presented it, if an Eighth Amendment violation is found, that would be contrary to law. I have not presented in the briefing any other argument that her sentence would be contrary to law. I've relied on, for the first proposition, I've relied on her sentence being clearly and convincingly not supported by the record.
Well, if we look at State v. Bryant, which just was issued recently, we talked about whether the trial court was influenced by impermissible considerations or whether the sentence violated the Ohio or the United States Constitution. Could we apply that line of thinking?
Yes, I believe so. To the extent that I contend that there is an Eighth Amendment violation here, that could serve as the basis for finding her sentence contrary to law.
And if we don't find Eighth Amendment violation, particularly in light of Hairston, is it reversible? Do we find under 29, 2914C4, under the consecutive sentences analysis, that the record doesn't support consecutive sentences?
Correct. And that would principally be because the wording in C4 is in the conjunctive towards the end of the first paragraph of C4. So there needs to be a finding. There are two or three findings, and then finally a finding that's preceded by an and that must, it's essentially a hurdle that must be cleared, that consecutive terms are not disproportionate to the danger the offender poses to the public. And that's our primary contention today, is that Ms. Gwynn, the nature of her offenses, her acceptance of responsibility, her lack of prior criminal convictions, all of those things taken together would allow this court to be to firmly believe that the record does not support consecutive terms. There are no further questions. I'd reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Mark Sleeper on behalf of Delaware County Prosecutor Melissa Schiffel, on behalf of the state of Ohio. I'm joined today by amicus from the Attorney General's office, who's asked to share in 5 minutes of our argument time and asked to reserve those 5 minutes for her. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Ms. Gwynn stole more than 3,000 items from residents of nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Based on investigation, we were able to identify 46 separate elderly victims who were the victims of her thefts. 31 of those had felony offenses that were committed against them, and 17 of those 31 felonies were second-degree felony burglary charges. Those burglary offenses contained, at the time, a potential penalty of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 years in prison. They also contained a presumption under 2929.13(d)(1) that a prison term was necessary in order to comply with the principles and purposes of sentencing. Despite the trial court finding a number of factors making Ms. Gwynn's conduct more serious than the average offender, that the harm suffered by the victims were exacerbated by their age, that her relationship to the victims facilitated the offense, the trial court only gave her 3 years in prison on each one of those 17 burglary offenses.
You say only, but it's the accumulation.
Right, and so her total sentence is a direct result of the number of crimes that she committed, not because any cruel and unusual punishment was relayed upon her for any of those individual offenses. The only reason her total number is so large is because of the obscene amount of felonies that she committed against elderly victims who were confined to nursing homes or assisted living facilities.
But so then a 55-year-old woman is sentenced to 65 years in prison for those theft offenses with no weapon used and no one being hurt. I understand that legitimately those offenses had that time attached to them. But in the scheme of things, if you have someone who's sentenced to a life sentence, 55 years old, getting 65 years, that doesn't rise to an analysis for us of cruel and unusual.
Well, respectfully, I would disagree with the characterization of them as being theft offenses. The 17 burglaries were not mere theft offenses. They were not mere property crimes. Burglary is treated much more harshly than theft because of the violation of a person's sense of safety and security in their own home.
What was the circumstances of the burglaries?
That on a number of these offenses, she was actually not an employee of the facility. She pretended to be one so that she could sneak into the facility and go into their separately secured rooms in order to.
So it was theft under pretense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, but not she held a knife or gun to any elderly victim's head.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But I would also note that a secondary felony burglary is an offense of violence under the statute. So it is different than a mere property crime, and it should be treated as such. And so I think that, first of all, Hairston was correctly decided, that I think this court should hold again that an appellate court's role in reviewing a sentence is to look at each individual sentence. And as was pointed out, Saxon says that. That's what this court said, that a sentence is a combination of individual sanctions imposed for individual
correct.
Offenses.
Well, what about the consecutive sentencing analysis under 2929.14c?
I think it would be breathtaking for this court to find that somebody who committed 31 felonies against 31 separate elderly victims couldn't get consecutive time. I think that
But one of the finding is there's not disproportion to the harm posed by society. These were all done while she was employed as or pretending to be employed as nursing assistant, et cetera, nursing homes, jobs that she could not get today based on these offenses.
That's correct. She couldn't be legitimately employed there, but she could just as easily sneak in and pretend to be an employee.
And then that's probably more of a problem with the facility, allowing her to sneak in and pretend to be somebody she's not. But so how is the harm of what she did, as egregious as she was, particularly in scope and time, how is she still a risk to do that sort of behavior?
I would say two things. First of all, to talk about the harm that was caused, I think we need to understand that this was these residents' homes, that it wasn't just simply a room in a facility. And one of the victims indicated that she was so scared that she started sleeping with her walker in front of the door because she was afraid that somebody was going to come into her residence in the middle of the night and steal more of her things.
Counsel, did Ms. Gwynn save everything she took?
There's no way to know that. I mean, there were certainly bins full of all sorts of items.
I thought they identified 3,000 items.
Yes, but whether she stole others and threw some away or pawned some, or I would have no way of knowing.
There's no indication that she stole these items for, I'm going to just use the word profit.
Yeah, that's correct. Unlike, say, where we see a rash of quick thefts and then pawns immediately
right.
after.
There's
that was not happening.
She didn't do any of that. She had baskets and bins and drawers full of people's photos and, you know, in addition to, you know, pieces of maybe jewelry and, you know, other mementos, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. But I don't think that that means that that her burglary offenses are somehow less significant or that her punishment then becomes too severe. Because, again, I think that the harm that she caused to these elderly victims, and I want to say, not only is this crime underreported, victims' families indicated to us that, and it's in the transcript of sentencing, that when their elderly parent came to them and said, my ring has been stolen, they said, they didn't believe them. They thought they just misplaced it. So even in the context of where someone is trying to report this crime, oftentimes we don't know the scope or the breadth of what's going on. And so with regard to this appellant, we know 46 separate victims that she stole from.
Counsel, let me take you back to your discussion of looking at one offense at a time. In reading your brief, you seem to make the presumption that consecutive, if the trial judge decides to consec, that they're all going to be stacked consecutively. You would agree with me that we have no packaging in Ohio, correct?
Correct.
And since we don't have packaging, we're supposed to look at one offense at a time.
That's correct.
Why is it not required for the trial judge to, once the decision is made, like looking at the first offense, that he or she is going to impose consecutive sentences? Doesn't the statute also require that judge to look at each time, each offense before stacking?
I don't believe the language of 2929.14c4 says that. And the reason why is I think that it's written in a way that it's a binary choice for the trial court. There is a presumption in favor of consecutive sentences. If they make those findings, it says then that the trial court may.
There's a presumption in favor of concurrent.
I'm sorry, concurrent. Yes, I misspoke. Thank you. Yes. So there's a presumption in favor of concurrent. Once the judge makes those enumerated findings, it says then the trial court may impose these sentences consecutively. I can find no case law in anywhere in the state of Ohio where any court has ever said that a trial court must say, count one, I find this, here's the sentence, count two, I make this finding, it's consecutive, count three, I've got to make that finding again to impose a consecutive.
But isn't that inherent in the proportionality consideration that is plain language of the statute?
I think that the proportionality talks about disproportionate to the seriousness of the conduct and danger she poses to the public. I think that the court appropriately found not only that the seriousness of her conduct called for such a sentence, but also to protect the public. I think that those are supported in the record, and they're not clearly unsupported by the record, which is a standard review that this court must find.
What about, I mean, going forward, you know, to prevent her from, you know, our public safety, I guess, would be the consideration. Was the judge convinced that going forward, if he doesn't, you know, stack these, that she's going to be a risk?
I mean, I think that's in the findings of the trial court as set forth in the entry, but also what
based on what?
Based on the sheer scope and size of the amount of crimes that she committed.
That happened in the past. We're talking about the future.
But I think that's also reflective. We're not standing here sentencing somebody who's stolen a couple of items on two or three occasions. We're talking about somebody who, over an eight-year period, have victimized at least 46 elderly victims.
And, you know, she admitted that, and apparently there was a drug addiction involved.
She raised an issue of a drug addiction, but again, I think that some of the types of things that she was stealing are not the types of things that are reflective of seeking money for drug-seeking
exactly.
activity.
Exactly. She was, like I said, picking up people's pictures and mementos and, you know.
And also jewelry and other items that had
sure.
value. But I think that, you know, ultimately I think what's important here is that her behavior over that long period of time, I think the trial court can rely on as a predictor of what she would do in the future
so
if
that
she's
so,
not.
So society would only be safe if she were 120 years old when she got out?
I mean, I'm not saying that that 65 years is the only appropriate sentence that could have been imposed by the trial court, but I do think that it is supported not only by the statute and the findings, and I think it's also not violative of the Eighth Amendment.
So the Eighth Amendment reads, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. So there's a three-part analysis for determining whether or not that sentence would constitute cruel and unusual punishment. When I look at 65 years, it's for her, it's a de facto life sentence without possibility of parole. And when you compare it with other types of 65-year sentences, why is that not wildly out of the norm for burglary theft offenses?
Well, I would submit that any of the cases that have been cited by appellant or amicus on that side, none of them talk about somebody who committed this number of burglaries against elderly victims in nursing homes. So I think you cannot find a case that is that stands as the exact same unique facts as this case presents.
Now, usually a 65-year sentence is going to involve violence. It's going to involve, you know, a lot more than what we have here.
Well, I would say again that it does involve violence as a matter of law because she committed 17 burglaries that are offenses of violence.
All right, I understand but there was no physical violence against any of the victims.
That is true. And I want to make sure that amicus gets some time to look at this, but I would just urge this court in looking to fashion a rule. Don't fashion a rule that undercuts the sentencing set scheme in the state of Ohio just because this one sentence might be
all right, let me ask you before you sit down. Several courts have said this shocked the conscience.
The Fifth District indicated that twice, yes.
Okay. What are we supposed to make of that?
That those judges believed that this sentence was too harsh. But I think that as the Fifth District properly applied the law under Hairston, and as the Attorney General will certainly address the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, that there is no support for the idea that a sentence against an adult offender who've committed this number of crimes is grossly disproportionate. I don't believe that that supports a finding of cruel and unusual punishment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have a little over 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. Gwen's consecutive sentences for burglary and stealing from vulnerable nursing home residents do not contravene the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment sets a very high bar for those who would seek to have their sentences set aside. And Hairston says that you review the constitutionality of the individual sentences in assessing an Eighth Amendment claim, which makes sense because the Eighth Amendment is not a right to a group rate for committing multiple felonies. But even if you didn't look at Hairston, even if Hairston didn't exist, the total prison sentences imposed here do not violate the Eighth Amendment.
So in essence, life without parole is what we're talking about.
Well, we're talking about, Your Honor, it's a 65-year sentence, but what Ms. Gwynn is asking for is basically saying after the first victim or two, the other 40 victims don't matter.
Sure they matter. She'll still have the conviction on her record. She'll still have the finding of guilt on her record for everyone, for all the crimes.
She will, but here, what the trial court did was essentially impose a penalty, and frankly, at the low end of the range penalty for attributable to the crime against each victim.
But you just can't take it in isolation, and if Ms. Gwynn were 25 years old, maybe, but she is, or at the time, was 55 years old, and so you have a life sentence for theft offenses. I know there are the second-degree burglaries in there, but you have a life sentence for theft offenses. I mean, you get less time than that for killing someone.
Well, I understand that 65 years sounds like a long time, but consider, too, that
it's not just 65 years being a long time. It's 65 years on a 55-year-old.
Well, There's been some other cases, such as Harmelin in the U.S. Supreme Court, where somebody had life without parole for one offense, and they upheld that under the Eighth Amendment. Our jurisprudence is the same on that, and so...
But life without parole is a different... I mean, to get that involves usually a homicide, correct?
Well, Harmelin was a drug... It was a drug possession offense, and they got life without parole, and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld that.
Is that, and I should know the case, I'm not familiar with that case, is that recent times? I would think that's cruel and unusual too, quite frankly, but...
Well, it was a 1991 case, and the controlling opinion by Justice Anthony Kennedy upheld that and said it's, again, it's only the very rare sentence that's going to be an Eighth Amendment violation. In the Hairston case should be followed here, and it just recognizes the common sense proposition that if you commit a lot of crimes, you're going to get a lot of sentences. The sentence, even the totality, even if Hairston didn't exist, and we think you should follow it, but even if it didn't exist, the sentence here is consistent with Harmelin versus Michigan. The trial judge made quite a few findings in the sentencing hearing. I believe it's about around pages 21 to 31 around there, including that there was minimal remorse and that even though she hadn't had prior convictions, this was criminal activity over an 8-year period of time. If you think about it, 3,000 items over 8 years, that's basically stealing an item a day for that time period. And these are vulnerable elderly, which again, it's a unique situation because these crimes aren't even always detected, if you think about it. So when you do find somebody who's committed them, it makes sense to give them a strong sentence, to send a message to other would-be exploiters of the elderly that this is not something that you want to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, I forgot. You've got 6 minutes left. Sorry.
Thank you, Aaron. I'll try to be brief. I have a duty of candor to the court to address your question, Chief Justice O'Connor. There is a mention in the sentencing transcript that she did in fact sell some of these items and did pawn for monetary gain, but...
Counsel, a majority of these over here were family mementos, right?
Absolutely.
Photos of family, beloved family members.
Yes.
Which rings from marriages, yes?
Which is not problematic, but it suggests that there's a...
Isn't that a problem for seniors living in nursing homes? They have very few mementos and somebody's taking them?
Absolutely.
So why is it not problematic?
It is problematic in terms of the seriousness of the offense.
It's a very serious offense, taking from the elderly.
Absolutely. But in terms of the danger she poses to the public, which is a required finding in 2929.19c4, that fact doesn't go towards danger.
Even though she dressed up and faked it so she could be an employee at places she wasn't even an employee at.
Again, that goes to seriousness. She has not served a prison term, come out, and recidivated. She is not that type of offender. If she was, I wouldn't be making this argument.
Because they didn't catch her for 8 years.
That's accurate. They didn't. She committed these offenses over a period of years. Then she accepts responsibility. She's serving her prison term. Upon release, she would be subjected to a 3-year period of post-release control, which could include house arrest, which certainly can include unannounced visits to her home to see if she is re-engaging in this activity, which I don't think is very likely at all, but if it happened, they would catch it quickly because of the supervision.
Well, she could also have an ankle monitor?
I believe that could be included, yes.
She could be required to undergo mental health treatment as well, correct?
Yes. And I think those are the key points I wanted to make. Additionally, I would call the court's attention to, with respect to Harrison, I would call the court's attention to the State versus Davis case out of the Arizona Supreme Court that's in the reply brief that court had previously issued a Harrison-like ruling, but said in Davis that prior ruling could be, in effect, limited, that that the sentence that Mr. Davis received, even though it was for multiple offenses, did in fact violate the Eighth Amendment. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to either modify Ms. Gwynn's sentence or remand for resentencing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.